Hello, this is On Science from NPR, the weekly podcast from the Science Desk. I'm Andrew Prince. This week, we're bringing you stories of plants and animals. In California, we'll hear about how plants are migrating downhill. It's wetter there, but also warmer. Scientists have decoded the bedbug genome, and we'll tell you what that means for getting rid of the critters. But first this week, we'll start with two amazing tales of animals. The animal world is a noisy one, with a vast vocabulary. These are male prairie chickens, snorting through their enlarged air sacs as they strut their stuff in the American Midwest. Across the world in Africa, male hammerheaded bats hang from trees along riverbanks and sing for attention. A lot of this signaling is about sex, as in, hey, I'm here and available. But scientists in Spain have discovered a very different kind of signaling by birds called black kites. As NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, the birds decorate their nests with plastic, apparently to scare other birds off.
It's not just any kind of plastic. It's only white plastic, bits and pieces the birds scavenge and lay inside their nests alongside their eggs. Biologists wondered for years why these big predatory birds do this. So a research team set up in a national park in Spain. They recorded and videotaped kites in 127 nests for 5 years. And slowly, this decorating habit started to make sense. It was a signal by the strongest birds that they were tough and could protect their nests. Now, a lot of animals do this to show either toughness or sexual allure. They'll dance or bellow or display some overgrown body part. But Fabrizio Sergio of the Spanish Council for Research says this is a pose of a different color.
The most funny thing is probably that it's done in this case not through some parts of the body, such as a plumage or a very pretty song, but it's made through some objects which are collected and constructed within the nest.
Sergio and his team think it's a construction that signals bravado. Think Harleys and tattoos. But the bravado is real because only the stronger, tougher nesting pairs decorate this way. The weaker birds, the youngest and the oldest, do not. In fact, they actually rejected the plastic when scientists added it to their nests.
Some other individuals actually did not want it at all. They immediately removed it. And this was very extraordinary.
One reason could be that when the kites add plastic, their nest immediately draws attention and attacks by other birds looking for food or a new nest. The tougher birds fight them off, and after that, they're pretty much left alone. Steve Nowicki is an evolutionary biologist at Duke University.
You know, a male who is in his prime is going to put more decorations on because he can back up that signal. It's not a bluff.
But weaker birds don't have the wherewithal to fight a lot.
The young males or the older, more senescent males do it less because they're just less able to be successful if there is an aggressive contest that follows.
And apparently they know it. That's why the weaker birds threw out that plastic when the Spanish scientists added it to their nests. The birds realized it was false advertising that could lead to trouble. Nowicki says that's no mean feat.
That requires some capacity to self-assess, realize that the signal that you find on your nest is off, and then adjust it.
Nowicki says this signaling behavior works because the attacks keep weaker birds from bluffing. It means, in scientific terms, that the white plastic signal, I'm tough, is honest. But wait a minute. Is it really wise to advertise where your eggs are? One bird biologist, Jerry Borgia, at the University of Maryland, says he doesn't buy the toughness signal idea.
So to make a nest more obvious seems extremely strange.
He thinks the kites may be doing something quite different with the plastic.
Camouflaging eggs?
Eggs are white. The kites choose only white plastic. Maybe an array of white plastic in a nest is simply there to confuse predators that eat eggs. The kite study was published in the journal Science, and it may take more studies to confirm what's going on here. But for biologists, this is more than just bird weirdness. It's a clue to how evolution winnows out winners from losers. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
According to most scientists, one of the key distinctions between humans and other animals is our ability to use language. But here's a story that blurs the boundary between human language and animal noises. And it comes to us from our friends at Radiolab. Jad and Robert told the story to Morning Edition host Renee Montaigne.
Hey, Renee.
That's Jad Abumrad from WNYC.
And this is me, Robert Krulwich. Radiolab is a show where we get curious and we explore ideas.
Yeah, and sometimes we talk to animals.
Okay.
Well, not really, but we do have a story about a kind of animal talk.
We ran across it not in dolphins and not in chimps, but in the prairie dog.
Woo! Prairie dogs.
So here's the thing. Prairie dogs are these little rodent-like animals. They live under the ground in burrows. And when their community is invaded, they, you know, pop out of the burrow and they say, uh-oh, here comes the whatever.
Sounds kind of like chee, 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 chee.
So we spoke with this guy.
My name is Khan Slobodchikov, professor emeritus at Northern Arizona University.
Who's spent a whole lot of time
sitting out in the colonies,
recording prairie dog calls. And he now believes that these simple little rodents are like nature's wordsmith.
Well, the thing is that initially I recorded...
For instance, he began by telling us that the prairie dogs have different kinds of chees.
Different warning cries.
For different kinds of predators.
For example...
Humans, coyotes...
And...
Dogs.
Right.
Is this the kind of thing that we would actually be able to hear the difference between the calls?
I'm guessing that you could hear the difference.
You want to try it, Chad?
Yeah. Soren, could you just play those samples?
All right, so here's one... This is another one.
All right.
Okay.
Here you go. This is a third.
Those represent different predators?
Yep.
I can't tell the difference.
Can you? I mean, do you know what they are?
Human, dog, coyote.
Oh. Wow.
So, guys, wait. How does he? I mean, what difference is he hearing?
Well, he told us at first that, like us, he couldn't tell the difference. But then he took the sounds back to his lab.
Where we had a machine that allowed us to measure a series of frequency and time elements in the call.
And what this computer does is it takes the sound that the prairie dogs make, and it essentially looks inside for the ingredients inside the sound.
And what does that mean?
Well, it's kind of hard to hear with the chirp. But let me demonstrate with a different sound. Which to us sounds like a solid piece of noise.
Okay, yeah.
If you take away all of the high frequencies...
It becomes like a low bass buzz.
Yeah, exactly. But now, if you add those high frequencies back in really slowly...
Yeah, okay.
You'll start to hear these hidden overtones just pop out.
Uh-huh. So these sounds are kind of hidden in that original sound.
Exactly. So in other words, this sound... is filled with little ghost notes that we can't hear. And certainly the same is true of this sound. Except in the case of the prairie dogs, it seems their ears are tuned to hear all the different sounds within the chirp. Probably sounds to them like this whole layer cake of tones.
And Khan's computer noticed that the noise they made when a human walked through their village was different in tone from the noise they made when a coyote walked through their village. It was consistently different.
But there is a problem.
When he zoomed in on the, here come the human calls. These ones here.
He saw that from one human call to the next, there was a lot of subtle variation.
Much, much more than I would expect.
And that's when it hit him.
What if?
What if?
What if?
What if they could be describing the individual humans?
Oh.
Now, at that time, no one suspected that this might even be a possibility. But I thought, well... let's try it and see what happens.
So, Khan recruited 4 humans.
And he had them dress exactly the same. Same boots, same blue jeans, same sunglasses, everything the same except the color of their shirts.
We had a person in a blue t-shirt, person in a green t-shirt, person in a yellow shirt, person in a gray shirt.
Then he asked each of them to walk through the prairie dog village.
One by one.
Prairie dogs made their chirps.
And when we analyzed the results, there were significant differences.
Like what kind?
They essentially clustered around the colors.
Does that mean you think you can hear them saying, here comes the human in blue?
Right.
Versus here comes the human in yellow?
Right.
Wow.
Really?
Oh, I was astounded. I was astounded.
He was like, well, wait a second. These humans, they're not just different in their shirt colors. They're different in all kinds of ways.
Some of the humans were taller, some of the humans were shorter.
So we went back, reanalyzed the chirps, looked a little more closely.
And
he realized
we could tease out
that the prairie dogs were also commenting about
the general size of the human. essentially they were saying, here comes the tall human in the blue versus here comes the short human in the yellow.
And then almost to kind of top himself, he says, okay, if they can do colors and they can do shapes of animals, how about something totally abstract?
And it was just...
not from nature.
Off-the-wall idea at that time.
He went back into the prairie dog field and he built two large wooden boxes.
Sitting on stilts.
A good distance from each other.
150 feet. And we strung wires between the two towers.
His team then made cardboard cutouts of three different shapes.
A circle, a square, and a triangle.
And then they ran them out along the wire, kind of like laundry fluttering above you in the breeze.
Each shape would emerge from one of the tower blinds and fly something like about 3 feet over the prairie dog town. And what we found was that the prairie dogs could tell the triangle from the circle very easily. But they could not seem to tell the difference between a square and a circle.
Huh. Why not?
Well, my guess is that triangles kind of look like cocks. Circles and squares kind of look like terrestrial predators.
Nonetheless, what you've got here is a little rodent with a remarkably big vocabulary, including but probably not limited to short, fat, skinny, tall, blue, green, yellow, gray, coyote, human, hawk, triangle, and or square.
Yay!
Not bad.
You guys, that is so cool.
It is.
I mean, prairie dogs.
Yeah, and Kahn says this is the most sophisticated form of animal communication ever recorded.
And we should say he also thinks maybe other animals can do this kind of thing. It's just really hard to capture, record, and figure out what's going on.
Well, thank you both for sharing that one with us this morning.
My pleasure. Thanks, Renee.
That's Jad Abumrad and Robert Krowich from the show Radiolab, a production of WNYC. You can explore Radiolab at npr.org.
The U.S. is struggling in its current battle against bedbugs. One reason is that the little bloodsuckers have evolved ways to survive common pesticides. NPR's John Hamilton reports on a new study that uses genetics to help explain why some bedbugs just won't die.
The pesticide known as DDT pretty much wiped out bedbugs more than 50 years ago. But they're back. And Susan Jones of Ohio State University in Columbus says the challenge has never been greater.
We're dealing with a different bug than what we were decades ago when bedbugs were a problem in the U.S.
Jones says the modern bedbug is harder to exterminate. To figure out why, she and other scientists compared the genes of today's bedbugs with those of earlier bugs. Jones says that's possible because decades ago, a military bug expert started a colony of bedbugs that has lived in complete isolation ever since.
So it has had absolutely no exposure to insecticides. When you expose it to pesticides, the bugs just keel over.
Jones says she got her modern bugs from an apartment complex in Columbus.
They had had an ongoing problem with bed bugs, repeated insecticide treatments, and the bed bugs were not going away.
Suggesting they had developed resistance. So the researchers compared these new bugs with ones from the old colony. Om Prakash Mithapalli from Ohio State University in Worcester says they focused on the genes involved in getting rid of toxins, such as insecticides.
When an organism encounters a toxin, it basically breaks it down, or it basically modifies the compound so that it's easily excretable.
Mithapalli suspected modern bedbugs had genes that encourage their bodies to produce more of the enzymes that break down pesticides. And he says that's just what they found.
These enzymes are indeed higher in the pesticide-exposed populations compared to the pesticide-susceptible population.
Breaking down toxins is just one way bedbugs have evolved to survive the exterminator's nozzle. They've also come up with strategies to protect cells from specific poisons. Ken Haynes of the University of Kentucky has studied many populations of modern bedbugs exposed to common pesticides known as pyrethroids.
Many of those populations have a level of resistance that's quite extraordinary.
They can survive 1,000 times the amount of pyrethroid needed to kill a strain without any resistance. Haynes says all this new information suggests it may be time to try a different approach to killing bedbugs.
Instead of relying on the same insecticide generation after generation of the bedbugs, you'd rotate to a different class of pyrethroid or a different class of insecticide altogether with a different mode of action.
And he says it's a good idea to include non-chemical approaches, like steam. The new research appears in the journal Public Library of Science 1. John Hamilton, NPR News.
As the globe warms up, many plants and animals are moving uphill to keep their cool. Conservationists are anticipating much more of this as they make plans to help natural systems adapt to a warming planet. But a new study in Science magazine has found that plants in Northern California are bucking this uphill trend. NPR's Richard Harris explains.
Coping with climate change is quite literally an uphill struggle for ecosystems looking to remain in a temperature zone where they do best.
We see it consistently for mobile species such as insects and animals. A lot of the real foundation studies for this have come out of studies looking at butterflies, for example.
So Solomon Dabrowski at the University of Montana expected he'd see the same trend when he looked into historical movements of plants in a vast area of Northern California. He dug through a remarkable record of the region's vegetation, collected back in the 1930s thanks to a federal project started during the Great Depression. He then compared that with modern vegetation surveys.
And what we found was counter to our expectations. We found that, in fact, the preponderance of plants that in our study area, which is probably the northern half of the state, would be the simplest way to describe it, had actually moved downhill roughly 80 meters, so about 240 feet.
Individual plants don't move, of course, but the optimal range of many different species has been creeping downhill, so more new seeds sprouted downhill and more new plants took root. And this was true not just for annual plants, but for bushes and even trees. Why would that be, he wondered, considering that the area has warmed up? He and his colleagues say the answer lies not in the temperature, but in the amount of life-giving rain and snow. It turns out this region has been getting wetter.
These plants are tracking water availability more so than temperature.
Not that big a surprise when you come to think of it. But until now, ecologists doing this kind of study had mostly noticed a trend linked with temperature. Dabrowski says that still holds in many cases, but
the simple message that things are going to move uphill and towards the poles may not be the answer in all cases.
This adds some pretty big wrinkles to conservation plans. For example, it's not always a good assumption that protecting areas upslope from plants will help protect their future habitat as the climate changes. Plus, Dabrowski says, if ecosystems see their optimal temperature moving uphill and their water supply moving downhill, that could be quite awkward at times.
If a number of plants are actually moving downslope and organisms that are adapted to rely on those plants, such as butterflies, for example, which are more constrained by temperature, are moving upslope, you could have situations in which plant and animal communities are even disrupted further.
This is quite a sobering finding for ecologists trying to anticipate what will happen to natural systems in the coming century. Scott Laurie, a researcher at the Carnegie Institution of Science on the Stanford campus, says most of the research has been focused on the warming part of global warming.
One of the reasons that so many of our results on what we expect will happen with climate change have centered on temperature is because we know the most about temperature. Pretty much all of our evidence shows that the Earth is going to get hotter, and there's very little dispute about that. We don't know very much about precipitation, but that doesn't mean to say that we don't think precipitation is important.
Laurie says the new study underlines just how important precipitation can be. Unfortunately, in many parts of the world, scientists simply can't say whether climate change in the long run will bring more moisture or more drought. Laurie says California is a case in point. The various climate forecasts disagree.
So it's really a crapshoot in California whether we're facing a drier or a wetter future.
And that means it's entirely possible that the plant communities that have been marching downhill for the past 80 years will eventually reverse course and head back up the slopes. Richard Harris, NPR News.
That wraps up the podcast from the Science Desk at NPR. Remember, you can send us an email at sciencepodcast@npr.org and let us know what you'd like to hear. Tell us your ideas. That's sciencepodcast@npr.org. I'm Andrew Prince. Have a great week.